welcome back to today's Topical Currents, Joseph Cooper with Bonnie Berman. 2016 marks the 400th anniversary of William Shakespeare's death. In honor of the bard, Random House has commissioned contemporary novelists to write modern versions of Shakespeare's plays in prose. Kicking off the series is The Gap of Time by Jeanette Winterson, which updates The Winter's Tale, a complicated romance about an insanely jealous king who wreaks havoc in his life and the lives of his loved ones. Winterson sets her novel in present-day London and New Orleans, and the king is now a hedge fund manager married to a French singer. While her characters don't speak an iambic pentameter, Winterson still invests them with poetry in word and action. Literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez spoke with Winterson. He began by asking her why she chose The Winter's Tale of all Shakespeare's plays to retell.
The simple answer, it's got a foundling in it, an abandoned baby. And I am one. And, you know, those talismanic texts that we work with all of our lives, the books that we go back and back to, the ones that we remember, that get under our skin, always have some strong visceral connection with us on an experiential level or on an imaginative level. And when I first read that play when I was 16, I was looking for clues. I was reading things that would help me to read myself as a narrative, because when you're an adopted child, it's like starting a book with the first few pages missing or coming into the theatre after curtain up. You know there's something that everybody else has got that you didn't get. And so you have to reinvent yourself all of the time. And with this play, I thought, okay, at the shining centre is an abandoned baby whose possibility really allows this play to happen and allows time to move forward as the play continues. And the idea of Shakespeare doing that, you know, putting this shining child in there was very appealing to me. And so when the question came from my publishers, which one do you want to do? And I was the first person they asked. There was no debate. I said The Winter's Tale, and they said, are you crazy?
Because I expected Hamlet or Othello, one of the better known plays.
Yeah, that's right. And nobody's doing Hamlet. I think Gillian Flynn's doing Hamlet. But they thought people would pick something obvious. But actually, by and large, the writers involved haven't. You know, Margaret Atwood's doing The Tempest. Anne Tyler's doing Taming of the Shrew. You know, there's some interesting choices in there. The crime writer Joe Nesbø, the Norwegian's doing Macbeth. Maybe that's obvious, but maybe the other ones aren't.
Well, the interesting thing about the series, the Hogarth series, because again, it's all contemporary novelists taking Shakespeare's plays and retelling them or modernizing them, is that Shakespeare did that. All of his plays are basically borrowed, aren't they, from other stories. He reshaped, retold other people's stories.
Yeah, he never bothered to invent a plot. He wouldn't have understood why he should make that effort. He just took things, stripped out the working parts and put them back together to make something new of his own. And, you know, people used to accuse him of plagiarism all of the time, and they were right. But he didn't care. He just thought, anything that I can take, rob, pirate, borrow, I'm going to use. Because he had that kind of large imagination that just knew that you work with what already exists, but you make it your own and you make it new in a fundamental way. So doing a cover version, which is what this is in the spirit of Shakespeare.
We're speaking with Jeanette Winterson about her novel, The Gap of Time. Just to give people an idea of The Winter's Tale, very quick overview. It's about a king named Leontes who becomes insanely jealous, thinks that his wife has cheated on him, and destroys his life pretty much as a result. But then there is a sort of redemption at the end. The title, The Gap of Time, it has some connection to the play. What is the connection with the title?
Yeah, it's mentioned in the play twice, the idea of this gap of time, really that everybody falls into, but is also the space that allows new possibilities to happen. You know, it's the kind of story you see on CNN or Fox News every day. You know, the jealous guy who thinks his girl's sleeping with his best friend. She gets duct taped in the trunk of the car and pushed off over a cliff, tries to murder the best friend. You know, that's what happens. It's like Othello on speed, this play. But, you know, the weird thing is that, you know, in Othello, we know why Othello gets jealous, because he's wound up by Iago, who's just basically a jerk. But in The Winter's Tale, everything happens inside Leontes' head. It's like a post Freudian play 300 years before Freud. And because it's all in the guy's head, nothing can persuade him that his reality is completely screwed up. And that's what Shakespeare works with. And we all know people like that. They get an idea in their head and they just will not believe you. And that's the kind of tragedy of the play, that only when it's too late, when his son's died, when he thinks that his wife is dead, when he's thrown away the baby because he thinks that she's a bastard and he says he won't raise another man's bastard, does he realise the enormity of his crime? It then takes 16 years for the thing to come right. And what Shakespeare's really saying is, look, you can destroy lives overnight. You know, we're seeing that every day in the news, aren't we? But look how long it takes to rebuild a life.
Well, the phrase winner's tale in the Elizabethan age referred to fairy tales, to these diverting entertainments. And there's a fairy tale quality to the play. It's very hyper-real. It's not really realistic. Certainly, there are parts of it that seem very, very surreal. You are a writer who has made a name for yourself to a degree by making the real and the surreal, or the fantastic, merging them together. How were you able to do that in the novel when you were trying to modernize this play?
Well, the first part, it is hyper-real, you know, because it's a story of jealousy and rage and betrayal of friendship, you know, betrayal of everybody. But then it changes, it becomes odder and odder, actually, as this play goes on. So you have to be prepared to do what Shakespeare was always prepared to do, which was just to mix all this up and not worry too much. You know, the great thing is it's an imaginative construct, and in the imagination, nothing is off limits. You know, it's like in our dream world, where one thing sits by another. We never question our dreams. We know they feel very real to us when we're dreaming it. When we go to the theatre or the movies, you know, when we read fiction, if it works, we're absolutely in that world. And it's only later, you know, we think of it, yeah, this is a story, or it's crazy, or it could never have worked out like that. But in fact, it's a truth about the way we think. You know, we live very linear, logical, orderly lives governed by the clock and the calendar. We go to work, we eat, we sleep, we look after our families. But we all have an imaginative life, which includes our dream life, which is much more chaotic, actually much more interesting, and doesn't follow either ordinary linear time or ordinary logical experience. You know, we're made up of so much more than just the daily activity and the clock and the calendar. And I think why people keep going back and back to creativity in all its forms is because it tells us a truth about us that sometimes we get divorced from in this crazy modern world, which is all about just, you know, earning the money and then getting 5 hours sleep at night.
Well, we're speaking with Jeanette Winterson about her novel, The Gap of Time. Well, let's look at the novel itself. The king is now a hedge fund manager in London.
Well, I had to do that because I thought, I can't have a king.
Yes.
Because it's just ridiculous. So I thought, what's a king? A king is an alpha male who's used to getting his own way, telling everybody else what to do, thinks he can buy people off, is a time lord, a lord of the universe. He's kind of reckless with other people and arrogant. I thought, who would that be in today's world? And I thought, okay, it's obvious. I'll make him a banker.
And his wife is a singer.
Yeah. That's because this play has more songs in it than any other Shakespeare play.
Right. And but the interesting thing is there's another king.
Polixenes.
Polixenes.
Yeah.
He's the old friend of the crazy jealous king.
Yeah.
And you've made him, interesting enough, a video game designer. Why? Mm. Why did you make him a video game designer in this novel?
Well, I was updating it, and I want, you know, we've got these two friends, these boyhood friends. You know, one of them, Leontes, who becomes Leo, is kind of more aggressive. You know, he's a bit of a bully, but he's a kind of extrovert, outward character. His friend, Polixenes, who becomes Zeno, is a bit dreamier, a bit softer. You know, he's a really good friend. Of Leo's wife, you know, they get on well. It's just one of those lovely things that happens. You know, it doesn't mean that he's sleeping with her. He's not. That's the whole point. And I thought, what can I make him now that gives him agency in the world but puts him, you know, on the side of creativity? I didn't want to make him a writer. I thought it's too obvious. So I thought I'd make him a video game designer. I'd make him design a game called The Gap of Time that actually gets played out through the book as well. You know, I'm hoping that Sony or somebody will give me the money to make this game. It would be really great because, you know, women don't do gaming much, except kind of geeky women who don't mind, you know, thinking that they're dressing up in cloaks and killing trolls and orcs. It's really boring. You know, we need different kinds of video games.
Well, in the play, the girl, Pedita, which means, I think, lost one in Latin.
That's right, yeah.
She is sent off to Bohemia. Mm. In your novel, the girl is sent off to New Bohemia, which is the United States.
It is. It's New Orleans,
it's
really.
It's New Orleans. Why did you choose that setting?
Well, I thought Bohemia, you know, Bohemia is actually now in Czechoslovakia. It's never had a sea coast, but Shakespeare didn't care about that. He gives it one in the play because, you know, this is a crazy guy. Geography is not his subject. So I thought, what can I do with Bohemia? So I thought, all right, there's a lot of singing there. You know, it's a place that's a bit laid back. It's cool. It's different. It's opposed to the kind of metropolitan sophistries of the court in Shakespeare. And I thought, all right, so it's not a big city like New York or London, but it's a different kind of city with its own subterranean feel and culture. And I thought, okay, let's model it on New Orleans. And, you know, we'll make the shepherd and the clown in Shakespeare's play. I mean, who needs a shepherd and a clown? Into a couple of do the right thing black guys called Shep and Clo, who are coming home from a bar one night and they find the abandoned baby.
And Winter's Tale has the most famous stage direction in history, Exit Pursued by a Bear.
I love that.
Right, but there's no bear in your novel.
No, there was no bear when Shakespeare put this on at the Globe Theatre, first performed in 1611. But he was a showman and he knew that if people got word that there was a bear, you know, it's like the Twitter feed of the day, they'd all come because they think, hey, great, we're going to see somebody torn to pieces by a bear. So he just thought, I'll throw that in.
We need to take a break. When we return, we'll continue speaking with Jeanette Winterson. This is Ariel Gonzalez. You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Welcome back. This is Ariel Gonzalez. You're listening to Topical Currents on 91.3 WLRN. Our guest today is Jeanette Winterson, esteemed British novelist whose latest book, The Gap of Time, is a retelling of Shakespeare's play, The Winter's Tale. Miss Winterson, I'd like to talk about some of your other books, if I may, for a moment. You've had a very rich career. Your first book was published when you were 25.
Yeah.
It's called Oranges Are Not the Only Fruit, which may sound like a famous TV prison drama right now, but it's not. It's not set in a prison. Well, it is in a way set in a prison when you think about it, because it's autobiographical, loosely based on your upbringing. You were raised in a very Pentecostal family, but then later you revisited that experience in a memoir a few years ago. Why Be Happy When You Could Be Normal, which is a great title, by the way. And why did you decide to revisit that time after writing it in fictional form?
I never expected to, but 27 years after Oranges, my adoptive father had died, and I was going through some paperwork which suggested to me that my biological mother might still be alive. And in Mrs. Winterson had invented so many mothers for me, you know, bad mothers, mad mothers, dead mothers, drunk mothers, drugged mothers, exploding mothers. But she'd always said that my biological mother was dead. You know, she was herself, you know, something of a fiction writer. Anyway, I started this detective search for Biomar, as I began to call her, which I found very troubling. It felt like I was being stirred up at the cellular level of my DNA. I'd lose things, I'd forget things. And it was a really harrowing experience, and unexpectedly so. And I was writing all of this down for myself. And at the same time, I started to revisit Winterson World and think about those events. And I realised I was writing a narrative which was running together at great speed, you know, 15,000 words in 2 weeks. And the monumental force of this was such that I thought, OK, there's a book in here. I'd better go with it and see where it ends up. And I did. And, you know, we published it and it went around the world. And it's been a big success. But more importantly, so many, many people have written to me and said, look, you really helped me with this because I'm adopted. I found my biological parents. It wasn't a happy ending. I don't feel so guilty now. You know, you've helped me know about the pain, the difficulty. So it really got somewhere and reached people. And what else do you want to do in this life but help?
In the memoir, you recount a scene. Your mother, well, your adopted mother, was not happy with your novel, with Oranges.
No, indeed.
Are Not the Only Fruit. And she asked you to call her. And you try to explain it to her. You try to explain what you were trying to do in the book. Of course, she wasn't going to accept that.
No.
But there's one thing that I noticed. I'd like to read it, a little passage. What you were trying to do in the novel, and perhaps in all your work. I was trying to get away from the received idea that women always write about experience, the compass of what they know, while men write wide and bold. Why could there not be experience and experiment? Why should a woman not be ambitious for literature, ambitious for herself? Could you elaborate? What did you mean by that?
I meant that.
Well, yes.
simply that there's an idea. You know, it's very interesting. If somebody like Paul Auster or Henry Miller or William Burroughs, say, puts themselves in their own fictions by their own name, which they all did. This is widely admired. Milan Kundera does it too. And people think, oh, this is metafiction, you know, this is postmodernism. If a woman does it, i.e. me, it becomes confessional and autobiography. And this interested me very much when I was a young writer starting out 30 years ago, because there were so many sexist and gendered assumptions about writing. You know, I went to one of the best universities in the world, Oxford, and on my literature course, there were only four women writers, which were the two Brontes, Jane Austen and George Eliot. Virginia Woolf wasn't even taught, you know, and we're not, you know, that's not so long ago. So I was beginning as a writer, feeling as so many women had before me, that A, that there weren't very many role models, and B, there were so many assumptions that you had to smash about what was the territory that you could both employ and enjoy, you know, where you could go. So I wanted to challenge that, and I wanted to change it, and I wanted to be able to use myself as a fiction as well as a fact, and also say, look, you know, the point is that you can tell any story you like, but it won't be in print 30 years later unless that's got some big imaginative punch in it, which is going to reach other people, which of course Oranges is and still is. So, you know, separate to my work as a writer, I was also doing, you know, political work, propaganda work, you know, as a woman, as a feminist, I'm proud to be a feminist, to say, let's smash some assumptions about what literature is and how women write and work.
We're speaking with Jeanette Winterson, whose latest novel is The Gap of Time, a retelling of Shakespeare's play, The Winter's Tale. Well, part of your experience is religious oppression. Mm. You grew up, as I said, in a very, very strict religious upbringing. And when you were 16, you left home because you came out as gay to your adopted parents, and they didn't exactly embrace that fact. And you had to support yourself pretty much for the rest of your life. You worked your way through college. You had a tough upbringing. This, again, is something that a lot of young gay people, teenagers, have to deal with, especially if they grew up in very religious families. So what could you, you know, I don't want you to give a public service announcement, but what could you say to people like that, to young people like that?
Yeah, it's heartbreaking when your family reject you out of some sort of moral code of their own and ask you either to, you know, be somebody you are not, or just leave or go, which was, you know, what that's where the line came from Mrs. Winterson, because she said to me, you know, why are you doing this? And i.e. having fallen in love with another girl. And I said, look, it makes me happy. And she said, why be happy when you could be normal? You know, she was a violent philosopher. But it was the right line for a girl like me to go away on. You know, I spent about the next 40 years thinking happy, normal, normal, happy. Is that a real binary, like black, white, good, evil, male, female? And then I thought, no, it's not actually a real question. But, you know, you have to work that out. So what I'd say is that the important thing is to be courageous at all times and to make difficult decisions if you have to, because warping or stunting yourself just leads to mental illness and misery. You know, there is no good side to being who you're not. You have to risk it in order to be who you are, even if that means you get kicked out, you have to, you know, do shitty jobs for a while. You know, you have to work your way through till you find your own comfort zone, your own peace and happiness. We have to do that. You know, I think everybody has a right to discover who they are, and nobody has a right to tell another person, you know, you don't fit in our world, so leave.
One thing that fascinates me about your work is your approach to history. Because again, history, again, it's a cliche, but history is not her story. It's very masculine. You know, women are either footnotes or they're pushed to the side. They're supporting characters for the most part. But you really look at history and you try to change that.
Mm.
Some of your books, like Sexing the Cherry, which is set in the 17th century London, or one of my favorites, The Passion, which is set in the Napoleonic Age. But there's one which, again, they're all deal with women in that particular time. But there's a book that came out recently that I was interested in, about witches, The Daylight Gate. Could you tell us about that?
Yeah, that's set in Lancashire in England. It's all set around the events of 1612, which is the first documented witch trial anywhere in history, and is, of course, the bedrock for the later Salem witch trials in Massachusetts. And it's because it was recorded so carefully that that testimony was then taken over to America and used at the time. It was a terrifying trial in that these were ordinary women, on the whole not educated, who were all burned for being witches. You know, it was a time in England, King James I was on the throne, and he wrote his own book called Demonology, the first monarch ever to do so. And the first thing he did when he came to the throne was pass the Witchcraft Act. And, you know, Shakespeare was writing The Winter's Tale when King James was on the throne. So Shakespeare's doing quite a risky thing at the end of that play, where there's the whole question of magic happening, where a statue comes to life. You know, he's like really running a risk there. Sometimes, you know, when you look at something in context and you think, wow, you know, you were in real trouble if you're professing witchcraft or magic in any shape or form. It wasn't the case under the old Queen Elizabeth. As soon as James hit the ground running, you know, he was terrified of witches. Macbeth was written when James was king. Again, you've got the three witches at the beginning. Shakespeare is using this kind of witch hunt, witch scare in his own time and commenting on it in a very interesting way. So I thought I'd look at it. You know, I was brought up in Lancashire. It's my county. I was brought up under the shadow of Pendle Hill, where the witches supposedly lived. And I thought, yeah, okay, I want to write about this. You know, it was offered to me a bit of as a dare. Somebody said, do you want to write a novella about the Lancashire witches? And I thought, no. And then I thought, okay, why not? You're a writer. To fix it.
And the fear of witches is connected to the fear of women, isn't it?
Absolutely, you're right. It is.
And again, James is interesting because you mentioned King James, because a closeted homosexual who had a lot of problems with his sexuality and with his relationships with women, with his queen. But not just him, but other men as well. There's this fear of women expressing themselves magically, supernaturally, or just in any way creatively. So they have to be suppressed. They have to be brought down.
I think that was very clear at that time, you know, and also he's in the shadow of Elizabeth, the old queen, you know, Gloriana, as she was known of, you know, at that point, the most successful monarch in the history, you know, of the British Isles, and also much loved, seen as a kind of goddess, a magical figure in her own right. So that was also a legacy that he was trying to do away with. So there's, you know, there's a political push here. I love history. You know, it's so interesting to kind of go back in time and think, what was really going on? You know, there's nothing boring about the past.
Well, thank you for coming in. We've been speaking with Jeanette Winterson.
Literary contributor Ariel Gonzalez is an English professor at Miami-Dade College. That's our program for today. Thanks so much for tuning in this afternoon. Our lead producer is Richard Ives, with technical direction by Paul Leary, our online producer as well. Polly Landis is associate producer. We have free audio archives of the program at our website, WLRN.org. More information and links at the Topical Currents Facebook page. Tomorrow's program is an At Your Service edition with well-known tech law attorney, author, and lecturer Mark Grossman. We'll take questions about the digital world legalities and how to safely navigate them. Bonnie Berman for Joseph Cooper. Stay tuned for Here and Now, up next from NPR News.